Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Ice podcast. We have been beginning to look at Shakespeare's last play, The Tempest, or at least it seems fair enough to refer to it as his last play. Technically speaking, that's not quite true, but on a figurative level, it is in several ways, and seems to have been regarded that way more or less by Shakespeare himself. It has many earmarks, as we'll see, of being a kind of a going out piece, a kind of farewell, and the figure of Prospero the magician has some pretty definite autobiographical overtones, which is certainly rare for Shakespeare. The play is one of the four final plays in a new genre, new to us anyway, known as the romances or sometimes the tragicomedies. And these four romances resemble the early comedies, and yet at the same time, they are different from them and an evolution from comedy to a form that in some ways goes beyond comedy and goes beyond, as the word tragicomedy suggests, even goes beyond the conventional division of dramas into tragedy and comedy that goes all the way back to the classical world. Tragicomedy is something new and yet in a certain way something that has very old roots, as we'll see. The Tempest opens, true to its title, with a tempest, thereby giving a headache to theater directors. How do you portray a storm at sea on a stage? And with the additional question of why did Shakespeare bother to put this theatrical obstacle right up front here? Well, one answer is that he needs the imagery. He needs the imagery of the sea and the tempest. The Tempest is yet another of the sea comedies, or in this case, sea tragicomedies, along with several others, including Twelfth Night. And the imagery is always the same, so we will be able to import some of what we've already seen in Shakespeare's imagery into this play. Here is the coming of chaos and at least potential or symbolic death. And sure enough, the ship that is caught in this tempest, everyone is in dire fear of death, imminent within a very few moments. They are barely coping with this storm, and at the end of the scene, in fact, the ship goes under, seemingly to death. Normally, it would be to death. Why portray this, given the theatrical difficulty on a second level, is to show that this threat of death becomes a touchstone for the characters that are involved in the storm. And we saw this last week. Alonso and Ferdinand, redeemable characters, are below decks at prayer. The two villains, Antonio and Sebastian, are on deck getting in the way of the sailors who are yelling at them to get out of the way and getting cursed at for their troubles. They are contrasted with the aged but wise courtier Gonzalo, who in addition to being wise, is patient and with a sense of humor. Even now, under the threat of death, it takes no more than about a dozen lines to characterize Gonzalo as a very admirable and almost lovable character, a characterization that will only increase as the play goes on. But when the ship appears to split and go down, suddenly the scene switches, and we encounter the main character, Prospero the magician, and realize, because Prospero tells us in the process of telling his daughter, Miranda, that in fact, first, the storm has been raised by his magic, and second, that means that actually no one is dead, everyone is okay, and the characters have been disposed about the island that they are on, as he says. He has just finished that job, and the stage direction in Act 1, Scene 2, around line 25 or so, is laying down his magic cloak and staff. Prospero says, addressing it, "Lie there, my art." And he goes on just a couple of lines later to say, "I have with such provision in mine art so safely ordained that there is no soul, no, not so much perdition as an hair, betid to any creature in the vessel, so don't worry, Miranda." But he has done this through the magic that he calls my art, and that was a common term in the Renaissance for magic, the magical arts. But we quickly realize that this is one of the autobiographical double references in the play. Prospero is a magician, but his magic largely consists in the mounting of theatrical illusions. He claims to be able to do much more than that, but in fact what we see is largely an art of creating illusions for the people on the island. In other words, he is yet another and the final and finest and most famous of what Northrop Frye referred to as Shakespeare's deputy dramatists, characters within the play who put the other characters in the play through a kind of drama within the drama, a play within the play, puppeteering them to ends that, at least in the comedies, are benign, but nevertheless arts of illusion and arts that really are theatrical in every sense. Prospero reassures his daughter Miranda that no one is really hurt, but says that I have a job to do. The Tempest is, if not Shakespeare's shortest play, at least one of the couple of shortest plays. And in one way, there is a constant sense of time being limited, time running out of foreshortening. And Prospero himself is highly aware that he is working against the clock, and he makes constant references to what time it is and how little time he has to pull off what it is that he is trying to accomplish. And this amount of time amounts, as critics point out, to about the running time of the play itself. In line 241 or so, in this very long scene, The Tempest is quite fond of scenes that take up all or nearly all of an entire act, and perhaps that's part of the foreshortening. But around line 241, Prospero makes one of many references to what time it is. Ariel tells Prospero, "Past the mid-season is the hour right now." And Prospero says, "At least two glasses." What that means is mid-season would be noon. It is, in other words, 2 o'clock or early afternoon. And he goes on to say, "The time twixt six and now must by us both be spent most preciously, between 2 and 6. In other words, as critics point out, approximately the running time of a play that would have in the Elizabethan Theater been in the afternoon, not the evening, because the Globe, at least, was an outdoor theater with no artificial lighting. Therefore, performances pretty much had to be in the afternoon before the sun went down. So in one way, we have a play that, in a curious way, observes the neoclassical unities supposedly laid down by Aristotle, where a play was supposed to have unity of time and place, confined to one place and confined to a very limited amount of time, often fixed at 24 hours or so. And The Tempest is going to expire in a time even shorter than that. And yet, like all four romances, The Tempest is also at the same time exactly the opposite of limited and unified in time. It extends actually over much of a lifetime, a long stretch of time in which many things happen. The action that comes to a head right now is the end result of something that stretches far back into what, in a famous, often quoted line, line 50, Prospero refers to as the dark, backward, and abysm of time. All four of the romances take much of a generation to transpire. And in the last two, The Winter's Tale and The Tempest, that generation's worth of time is symbolized by the growth of a female figure from childhood or even babyhood to adulthood. In The Winter's Tale, between acts 2 and 3, there is a gap of 16 years, and a newborn baby in the first two acts appears suddenly in act 3 and following as a grown woman interested in the male lead. And that's exactly what will happen here in The Tempest, except that the gap here, very cleverly, Shakespeare has inserted before the play begins, rather than interrupting the play with a gap in the middle like The Winter's Tale. Here, the gap has already occurred, and we are on the far side of it. The action that leads up to now began as Prospero begins to tell Miranda, began 12 years ago, and it began not here on this desert island, but back in Italy, where Prospero was Duke of Milan. He was a ruling figure. And yet, the problem was, as he goes on to tell his daughter, that unfortunately he didn't really have much interest in that job. There was a distinction that we have seen in Dante and runs all the way through the Middle Ages and Renaissance in the Christian tradition between the active and the contemplative life. This is in the Divine Comedy. Michelangelo in the Medici tomb sculpts the two Medici brothers in the figures of active and contemplative. And both of these life paths were supposed to be pretty much equally valid in terms of a life well lived and a life of eventual salvation, although the prestige was given actually to the contemplative life. What Prospero tells his daughter here is that by temperament, he was a contemplative. He says that what he really wanted to do was to read his books. He was, as he puts it around line 73, for the liberal arts without a parallel, and says, these being all my study, the government I cast upon my brother, and that is Antonio, whom we have already seen and already have a bad impression of from scene one in the storm, where he and Sebastian are cursing out the very sailors trying to save their lives. All I wanted to do was study. Therefore, I turned over the government to my brother, and to my state grew a stranger, being transported and wrapped in secret studies. He abdicated his responsibilities, and this evokes, because this is what happens in Shakespeare, the intricate, almost unbelievably intricate series of connections, echoes, and resemblances among all the plays, not just comedies to other comedies or even romances to comedies, but the entire tissue of Shakespearean drama has connections. And the more you study Shakespeare, the more you become aware of those connections, and they aren't just cleverness, they are illuminating if you pause to think about them. And here we have something that we have seen before in Measure for Measure, a duke. The duke in Vienna in Measure for Measure also does not like his job, or appears not to like his job, and also abdicates and turns over the government to somebody who turns out to be an evil character, Angelo. In that case, it's a little bit different because the Duke is not literally abdicating, he's only pretending to do so. But Prospero, 12 years ago, actually did turn over the reins of the government of Milan to Antonio, and that turned out to be a big mistake. All of this has to be explained to Miranda because it has to be explained to the audience, and this is the pretext. Prospero gives an enormous long speech. The advantage of putting the 12-year gap in the past is that it doesn't have to interrupt the play right now. The disadvantage is this necessity for a long backstory, which Prospero is telling to his daughter, Miranda, who was only 3 years old then. She was born, but she was only three, which means that she is 15 right now. She's a teenager, and she is very definitely at the age to be looking around at boys and looking for a husband, as we'll see when she casts her eyes upon Ferdinand not much further on. 15 is marriageable age in the Renaissance. We have to be careful about not projecting modern assumptions too far into these plays. She is young, and yes, emphasis is laid upon both her naivete and her possible immaturity. But we have to be careful, just as we have to be even more careful when reading Othello, not to cast Desdemona into the role of a modern giddy teenager. Desdemona is one of the impressive women that Shakespeare created, and she is not immature. She is not spoiled and mistaken in her choice. The person who wrecks it is Othello, much older than her, having no excuses for it. Desdemona is not a love-struck teenager who made a bad choice. That's a reductive way to read the play. Here, Miranda is young and naive, both because she is young and because she has been on a desert island literally all her life. She has not seen the world. She has actually seen nothing but her father and her father's magical servant, whom we will be meeting in just a few moments. But the advantage of not interrupting the play leads to this long lecture. Prospero plays many roles in this play, and they all echo against one another. They are all connected. They are not just piled onto one character randomly, but they all have connections, and they all go back to the theme of the use of power. Prospero was and should be and will be, again, a political figure wielding political power, even though he didn't yield it very responsibly. He is a magician wielding magical power. He is also, as I've said, an artist figure of a very real sort. Most of his magic is a kind of theatrical art. And I would add one more role. He is a teacher. He is here teaching his daughter. Miranda is homeschooled of necessity. They are exiled here and have been on a desert island without Gilligan for 12 years, and therefore he has had to bring her up in complete or almost complete isolation. He has already been her teacher, and he is her teacher now. But that role will extend further. He is the teacher in a very real sense. I am not, I think, forcing this onto him simply because I'm a teacher myself. I think it's a very real role that he plays in the play. There is a legend that Shakespeare, after he left Stratford-upon-Avon and before he went to the theater, spent a brief time as a school teacher himself. We have no proof of that. But nonetheless, this stand-in figure for the author is very much a teacher, and he is teaching the entire cast of the play by what these days in the academic jargon we call experiential learning. Some of these people are going to have to learn and be educated about certain things the hard way, though that's a more vivid way. Here, Prospero employs the other method, the more traditional method of teaching, the lecture, with the usual danger, because when you lecture a 15-year-old with a speech that, in fact, goes on for several hundred lines, you risk the result that, in fact, he gets. By the end of it, she falls asleep. And the speech is punctuated, and this should be played for humor when you're producing the play, with occasional, are you listening? Because clearly he notes that she is not, that she is distracted or bored or sleepy by the end of it. At one point, she says to him, I would say it's dryly, your tale, sir, would cure deafness. Yeah, sure, Dad. So he has to teach her by lecture, but everybody else is going to get the school of hard knocks. And for most of them, with the exception of Gonzalo, in fact, deservedly so, necessarily so, at any rate. He lectures her that, to refer back to the story, he put his brother in charge, and his brother, power went to his head, his ambition growing, line 105. And then he interrupts, dost thou hear? That's the point at which she says, your tale, sir, would cure deafness, right? And not enough. Some people, you give them power, and it only feeds an addiction. He needs will be absolute Millen. No good to delegate him power. He wants total and permanent power. Me, poor man, my library was dukedom enough. And it is clear, whatever one thinks of loving an education in the liberal arts, it is clear that this came as an abdication of his outward responsibilities. the contemplative virtue ceases to be a virtue if it is bought at the expense of outward duties. He had a job and he ignored it. And the result is, not just for himself this turned out badly, but he left the kingdom in charge of an evil man who was power-crazed, and in fact still is, 12 years later. And Antonio, not enough that he was evil in his own right, went and formed a conspiracy with the neighboring king of Naples, who was in fact Alonso, who is on board the ship that was just wrecked, and offered to give tribute to Alonso, do him homage, if you will join with me in deposing my brother Prospero. And they do so. They don't kill him, but they put him in a leaky boat with his three-year-old daughter and set him out to sea in exile, thinking that it is just really a way of prolonging an eventual death. But the one mitigating factor is that the one good member of the court party, as they come to be called, Gonzalo, put aboard that boat before it was set adrift Prospero's books. And that sounds like more humor than, oh, well, you know, the bookworm is content to be exiled to a desert island, so long as he can read his books. And there's probably some truth to that, but actually it means much more than that, because these are Prospero's magic books. These are not just that old parlor game of what books you'd take to a desert island. The real answer to that is given by the Tempest. You should take magic books so that you have power to make your life there actually worth something, and that is exactly what happens. Without that, it is doubtful whether Prospero would have survived. And it was Gonzalo who did that, and it was a providential thing. Volumes that Prospero says around line 168, volumes that I prize above my dukedom. And I'm not done. I now, by fantastic luck, or something more than luck, we will talk about, you know, the wild chance that 12 years later, the court party coming back from a wedding just happened to be going by the island where Prospero and his daughter are marooned. Is this chance or some larger design working? One of the themes of the play, one of the themes of the romances, of a design working itself out over time. A design in the comedies works itself out too, but quickly, resolving itself into something, to refer again to the unities, into something that is much more short-term. A twist, an immediate turnaround, and a happy ending. Here, there is a happy ending, but it is, one, eventual, and two, the intervening time is a time of trial, tribulation, and in some ways, losses, some of which are made up for, and some of which are not, just as in life. In a strange way, the romances seem, if you read their plot summaries, seem to be a kind of primitivism, a kind of return to some of the naive dramas of the 1580s or so, when Shakespeare was young. And yet, in a different way, they are more sophisticated. They are dealing with something that is much closer to the way that life itself is. The question of what has happened over much of a lifetime. Shakespeare, when he wrote this play, was himself fairly close to the end of his own life. He was only in his late 40s, but he would die at 52, and there seems to be a sense of mortality hanging over the figure of Prospero, and therefore of Shakespeare. There is also the issue in the romances of disposing of marriageable daughters, and Shakespeare had just gotten done going through that with his own two daughters. And when you do that, when you come to the end of your career and your children leave home and have their own lives, you look back on your life and you say, what was that all about? And you try to sum it up and decide what it was worth, what you succeeded at, and what you failed at. And that is all in this play too, in a very real way. As they say, if you look at the plots of the romances, they look like fairy tales. Once there was a magician and his beautiful daughter, but in another way, they are dealing with some fairly profound issues on a symbolic level. And educating us, perhaps, teaching us. Shakespeare is examining in this play, what is the purpose of art? Lie there, my art. What is the purpose, particularly of his own art, the theatrical art? And the old phrase, coming from the classical past, from the Roman poet Horace, that the purpose of poetry was to delight and instruct. That is very definitely pertinent to Prospero's role as a teacher, as an educator. And all of these various roles that he plays are aspects of a single thing, the creative or the destructive use of power in politics, in art, in education, all summed up in the metaphor of his magic. Here, he is teaching his daughter, and even says so deliberately. This is not just an inference of mine, but he refers to himself in line 173 as I, thy schoolmaster, to Miranda. He has been teaching her, and we will find out, he made at least an attempt to teach one of his two servants, Caliban, taught him language, tried to teach him other things, but when you're a teacher, sometimes it takes and sometimes it doesn't. Prospero regards his efforts with his pupil, Caliban, as a complete failure. We'll have to decide what we think about that. When you teach, you are always looking at what have I succeeded in doing for my students positively? What have I perhaps failed to do, at least for some students? And when I failed, was it their fault? The student just wasn't up to it or not motivated or not responsible? Or was it mine? Or was it a complex interplay of both? Teachers live with that responsibility. And here again, we have the theme of responsibility in use of power. Teaching is a wielding of power. And I don't think I'm overplaying it to emphasize this role. It's the least obvious of his roles, but I think it's a very real one. At any rate, Prospero, as he tells Miranda, just before she falls asleep, I have a job to do, and I have only got a short time to do it. And if she hadn't already fallen asleep, Miranda could have replied, well, why are you making 300-line speeches then? Get busy. But he will do that. And in order to do that, he will have to call upon his two servant characters. And these are servants that are his servants through the power of his magic. And they come on in the typical Shakespearean way. Shakespeare, as I have said in play after play, mindful of the theatrical necessity of introducing a multiple cast in succession rather than all at once and thereby totally confusing the audience. He will usually do it quite methodically through the course of the first, in maybe the beginning of the second act. We have already met the group that will become known as the court party, the members that were on board the ship. Now we have Prospero and Miranda, and one by one come in Prospero's two magical servants, Ariel and Caliban, contrasting characters. And these are characters that are associated with the elements, because in the Renaissance lore of magic, good magic, white magic, was what was often quite literally called natural magic. It drew upon the powers that were held to be latent in nature, and particularly in the four elements: earth, water, fire, and air. Ariel is the first one, and Ariel, as the name suggests, is associated with air. And if you look at the Dramatis Personae, this is quite literal. Ariel is defined in the Dramatis Personae as an airy spirit, but also at least once with fire. In the shipwreck scene, Ariel generates what's known as St. Elmo's fire, a form of lightning phenomenon that sometimes actually does occur. So the two light and upward elements of air and fire, followed by Caliban, who is first referred to on first reference as thou earth, associated with the heavy elements of earth and water. Caliban appears, at least to some people, to be somewhat half fish, or at least a fishy character. So Prospero commands the forces of the elements personified here. He has other servants, unnamed, and sort of a collective pack as well. And through those, he is going to set about working on the court party, whom he has disposed, as he tells Miranda, about the isle, and we will take up that process next time.